The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Afternoon, everybody.
Yeah.
What do you say, Norm?
Any cheap, tawdry thing that'll get me a beer.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Retirement IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Those of you Gemini's generation, and probably younger as well, and a bit older, I'm sure recognize Norm Peterson from Cheers there. We're playing a little respect to George Wendt, the actor who recently passed away, played Norm Peterson for many years on the hit TV show Cheers. So we'll sprinkle some Normisms throughout the show today in honor of George Wendt's passing. I know Jim's a big fan of Cheers. I was as well. Most people were, I think. It was must-watch television for many, many years. I don't remember. Was that a Thursday night? Was that back when Thursday nights were kind of the big television night?
Yeah, it was back when Thursday was yeah. King of weekly TV.
Yeah.
And there was an NBC, wasn't it? Oh, was that? I don't think it was CBS. I think it was NBC.
I think it was NBC because Peacock did a kind of a honorarium for him.
Okay, but what is odd is before George passed or George, is it Wendt or Wendt? How have you
just Wendt?
Wendt. George mm-hmm. Wendt passed, otherwise known as Norm. I watched all 11 seasons just recently of Cheers. Every evening before falling asleep, I'd watch a couple. And it ended, for me, a couple of months ago, and then Norm passes away. But I watched it on the Peacock Network, Chris, mm-hmm. and that's owned by Paramount Network. And that's where I streamed it, and that's CBS, but maybe they have the distribution rights to it. It gets very confusing sometimes on these programs. But I think it was when it was on regular TV in the 80s. I think it was an NBC.
Yeah, it definitely was NBC.
Okay. But yeah, for those who haven't heard, Norm, who is to me the best character, one of the better characters on Cheers, Kelsey Grammer, his character, Frasier, was also pretty funny. But Norm passed. And a little bit of trivia that the obituary did say was that Norm, Carla, and Sam were the only characters that were in all episodes. Everyone else didn't appear. There were some episodes where the others didn't appear. But every episode had Carla, Norm, and Sam in at least that episode. So a little bit of interesting trivia. So we just thought, folks, it would be nice to put a few little Normisms. Everybody knows when Norm would walk into the bar, everybody would shout, Norm! And then as he's walking from the door to the bar, as Chris just played, somebody would ask Norm how he's doing, and he would come with one of these little catchphrases. And some of them are pretty funny. I think Chris has my favorite. He knows which one my favorite is. And if he plays it, I'll let everybody know that that snippet was the one that I laughed the most at when I heard it. But yes, he did pass away, and I guess Norm became the other guy, folks. We keep talking about that, that one of the reasons we come up with our approach to retirement planning, what we call collectively the Secure Retirement Income Process, but it's otherwise known as the Fund Number Approach to Retirement Planning. The reason we believe so passionately in helping people determine what their fund number is and helping them spend the majority of that during what we call the go-go years of retirement is you don't know when you will be the other guy. And you will be the other guy when something bad happens to you. And whether that's passing away, as George Wendt did, or someone you know passes away, or suffers something catastrophic, or you suffer a medical condition, whatever the case may be, your ability to spend on fun has been greatly curtailed or just ends. That, to us, is a bigger risk for the majority of people listening to this podcast who have amassed several million dollars and outliving their assets, although still a potential, is not really a practical risk for them. But underspending on fun is. And that, to us, is, can be a much bigger risk that you spend the last few years, relatively speaking, to your entire life to get you to the point where you're in your 60s or early 70s. George passed away at 76, I believe. Relatively speaking, at the phase of life you are with the number of years you have left, you don't have many good years left for spending on fun. And not spending enough money on fun during that critical go-go phase to us is as big a risk as outliving your assets could be. But again, most people listening to this podcast or any podcast or taking their investing and retirement planning seriously have amassed enough money to retire. Now, whether or not they can retire at their hoped-for lifestyle, that's a whole other story. But they've amassed enough money where outliving their assets probably isn't the issue. Now, that's not for everybody. The vast majority of Americans don't take this seriously at all. They don't save nearly enough during their working years. They pay way too much in fees if they hire another financial advisor to help them. And for whatever reason it is, failure to save, failure to invest appropriately, paying too much in fees, whatever the case may be, they just have not amassed enough money to retire at their chosen lifestyle period. Our approach to retirement planning or any approach to retirement planning isn't going to be able to help them. But for those who have amassed enough, one of the reasons we believe in the fund number approach to retirement planning, at any day you could be Norm. You could be George. You could wake up, you're not going to wake up dead, folks.
Wake up dead one day.
Going to wake up. Yeah, I know. I said that once. And
I think you've said it more than once.
I think it was only once. But you all know what I mean. You're not going to wake up because you're dead. You're not going to wake up dead. You could theoretically wake up dead, Chris, because you'd be in heaven. You'll just wake up in heaven. But whatever the case is, you're gone. You're not here anymore. Or something else has happened, whether it's a stroke like happened to me, but a stroke that you don't fully recover from, which through the grace of God I did. You could be diagnosed with some horrendous disease, or someone you love has this happen to them, and your ability to spend on fun is greatly curtailed, if not totally eliminated. That's what we mean by someday you'll be the other guy. And for George Wendt, unfortunately, that was in the not-too-distant past. I think it was just a few days ago.
Yeah, it was May 20th, I believe.
And we're recording this on May 22nd, so not too long ago. So that's why we're going to stop playing some George. But also, again, to get you guys to understand, if you're a longtime listener to our podcast, it's either because you, for some reason, like Chris and I, and you just want to keep hearing what we have to say, or you at least find some of what we talk about with the fun number approach to retirement planning appealing. And it's one of the reasons Chris and I don't care for the safe withdrawal, Monte Carlo-based, probability statistic-driven approach to retirement planning. Whether it's the pure straight withdrawal, or the guardrails, or the ceiling and floor strategy, which are the guardrails and ceiling and floor are designed to take out a little bit more than the safe withdrawal rate in up years and curtail it in down years. And maybe it has a little more flexibility and a little more ability to spend than the straight line method, if you will, of just taking a certain amount adjusted for inflation each year. But all three of those approaches, as far as I'm concerned, unnecessarily curtail spending on fun. And to me, for the majority of people listening to this podcast, that is a far bigger risk than outliving your assets. It's not like this life is the dress rehearsal for the real thing. And we could say, I blew it this life. My next life, I'm going on that cruise. I'm going to go on that trip. I'm going to go pay for the education for my grandkid. Whatever the case is that you're going to regret never doing, it's not like you're going to have a do-over. Sadly, this is it. And when you're done, you're done. And that's what happened to George, and that's why we decided to play this. Not George. Yeah, George. But Norm, and that's why we decided to play these snippets, and you'll hear them throughout today's Q&A show. All right, Chris, I rambled enough on that, but hopefully people get what we're trying to do.
Yeah, sounds good. So we got a Q&A show up for today. Typical schedule, I'm pretty sure. Apologize if somebody can hear the honking horn outside the...
Yes, studio. I can hear it clearly. Zoom's not doing a good job removing it from background noises. Some alarm going off near you?
Seems like it's in our driveway, so hopefully it's not your car.
To the best of my knowledge, my Subaru does not have...
No, it doesn't sound like that, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know my Subaru had that. If it does, I don't even know how to shut it off. It's certainly not Jacob's truck. He's got a 30-year-old Ford Ranger out there. I don't think that even thing had alarms. So I have no idea what it is, but yeah, I can clearly hear it. Yeah.
Well, you can dive into the first question when you're ready. And it stopped. Somebody fixed it.
Excellent.
Live recorded podcast.
All right. So the first thing that we're going to do is put a new twist on the Q&A that we normally do.
Uh-oh.
So... here's what I said to Chat. I came up with a new way because ChatGPT keeps cheating. So I said to Chat, I said, hey, Chat, since you can't stop cheating with Chris by going on the internet, I am going to change the rules. What we are now going to do is have you, meaning ChatGPT folks, try to guess if you think Chris could get this answer correct or not based on how difficult you feel the question is for an average person to answer. What do you think of that, Chat? Chat said, I love that twist. It's a great way to keep the game fun, unpredictable, and fair. Given my tendency for rule breaking. I love how it admits it cheats.
Yeah, at least it knows it's not able to control itself.
Yeah, it can't control. It's like a 12-year-old kid, folks. Crazy. They really have to tighten. It knows it's cheating, but it still does it. Anyways, this will also give Chris a bit of a spotlight. I don't know what he means by that. And lets me work on reading the room and trying to gauge if Chris could get it correctly, rather than just blurting out my answer. he said, so from now on, you, meaning me, will ask Chris and I a trivia question. I am still going to give my answer, but then I will provide a guess on whether I think Chris got this right or wrong, based on how hard the question is and how common the knowledge would be for someone. Let's call this game, this is chat now, Chris. Let's call this game, Can Chris Crack It? Now, I didn't come up with that. But that's chat's idea of the name. Can Chris Crack It? And then it says, I'm ready whenever you are.
Okay.
So are you ready?
I'll do my best. I am ready.
You were born ready?
No, not for this. Nothing you're preparing me for this.
All right. So the first question is a Social Security question. And now I'm on my iPad. I don't have my laptop here, folks, so I can't have two screens open at once. Well, technically I can, but I can't talk into chat while reading the question. So I'm going to read the question, and then as Chris is deciding if he can answer, I'm going to put the question. I'll just paste the question into the chat box, Chris,
okay,
and let chat answer it. So
sounds good.
Okay, so the question begins, during the April 19th Q&A show, Chris addressed a Social Security question from a listener born in... wait a minute. Did this person give us a state hint? We might not even have a state question. That's the question. Where's the state question? Oh, here it is at the bottom. Let me skip that, folks, before we get to the actual question. Here is the state hint. I am from the state where Willie Nelson was born. Oh, I'm going to say you're going to get this.
Yeah, I think I know this one. So would you like me to answer and then you can... do the chat part while I'm answering the actual question?
I just sent it into...
Oh, well, that was quick.
Yep.
So I believe Willie Nelson is from Texas.
Okay, here's what chat said. Mm-hmm. Willie Nelson was born in Abbott, Texas in 1933, so my answer is Texas. Now, for the twist, do I think Chris can crack it? This is a relatively well-known piece of trivia, especially for Chris and country music fans or anyone familiar with American pop culture. That said, if Chris isn't a music buff, he might hesitate. But my guess, yes, Chris will get it right.
So chat was correct.
Chat was correct. So boom. I don't know how we're going to score this. I'll ask. While you're answering the question, I'll ask chat. How do we score this now? Yeah. Okay. So here is the actual question that the listener has. During the April 19th Q&A show, Chris addressed a Social Security question from a listener born in June. The listener was considering the following strategy. 1. Delay Social Security until 70. 2. Wait until January of the following year to submit their application. And then 3. Filing retroactively for 6 months of benefits. The goal behind this strategy was to minimize taxes by postponing Social Security until the next calendar year, potentially allowing for larger Roth conversions during the current year. However, Chris explained that this approach was not ideal because it would result in losing 1 month of Social Security payments. I'm in a similar situation, and I have a follow-up question for Chris. Instead of waiting till January of the following year to file retroactively, could the individual have filed in December of the year that they turned 70? Specifically, if the Social Security payments are actually issued in January of the following year, does this ensure that all Social Security income, including the retroactive amount, appears in next year's tax return, leaving nothing on the tax return for the year the individual turns 70, and I guess, Chris, by default, allowing for that conversion strategy, but perhaps not missing out on 1 month's benefits. What says you?
I'm actually really glad that they wrote in on this because I've been meaning to circle back to this, because what dawned on me after we recorded the show was exactly what they picked up on. Now, my answer to the listener's question back on that show was correct, because just kind of to summarize, The person who wrote in on the April 19th show question, they turned 70 in June. They were wanting to not file, wait past 70 to file, taking advantage of their ability to file 6 months retroactively, and wanted to file in January. I pointed out if they did that, 6 months back only gets them to July, so they would have lost their June payment, and then went on to describe that that, you know, probably wouldn't be worth it, the tax advantages to their Roth conversion, because it was a fairly modest-sized Roth conversion they were attempting. Didn't really make sense. What didn't dawn on me at the time, live, while we're dealing with that question on the podcast, is I should have suggested exactly what this listener pointed out. Don't wait till January. They had asked me specifically about January, so my mind was focused on, gee, that probably doesn't make sense because of the lost month. But if filing in December, they would not have given up a single month of payments, and the listener who wrote in this question today is exactly correct. As we all should know at this point, I know it, and most of you should because I've mentioned it many times, Social Security is paid 1 month in arrears. So your December benefit, even though you file for December as your start date, your first payment won't be till January, and it goes on that year's January's tax year as far as reporting that income. So that, for that original listener who sent in the question back on April 19th, that was the modification that would have solved their issue. They could have done what they wanted, just filing in December instead of January. And for others, always remember, you, even though you can file up to 6 months, you don't have to. That's just the maximum you can go back. So if you were born in, say, August or September, you could still do the same thing, wait to file until December, or at least you can file, you can put in the paperwork and just ask for it to start in December and ask for the retroactive payments, and they will then pay you in the following tax year, January, which is when December payments are made. And if you didn't file to start until December, now you might, if you try to do it ahead of time, they might point out, well, why are you putting it off till December and then filing retroactively? I'll just turn it on now, and you'll probably have to spend more time than you want explaining to them it's a tax strategy, and they still probably won't understand it. So I would probably err on filing, actually putting in the application in December, realizing that your payment, it'll take a couple of months for them to catch up on the paperwork because it takes a little time, but you'll be made whole then eventually once they get the claim actually processed. But excuse me, this listener, thank you for writing that in, because they picked up on exactly what dawned on me after the podcast that we did back on April 19th regarding this. So there's been a couple of times when in this case, it was for reasons of wanting to do a Roth conversion and not have the Social Security income count in the same year. But there would be other reasons that you might want to shift income recognition into the following year. And one way to do it is delay your filing of Social Security, but then claim retroactively. It's a way to accomplish your desired start date, but actually push things off up to 6 months. So doesn't help a lot of people, but for specific cases, it can be a little tool in your tool belt to help you with your tax planning, is usually where this comes up. So thank you, listener, for this one.
Perfect. I think that cleared it up a little bit. All righty. While you were answering that question, mm-hmm. I was having a conversation with your nemesis.
Oh, no.
So your nemesis thinks highly of himself because he was trying to, put the game in his favor. I wrote, hey, chat, how do you think we should score this new game? You were correct. Chris did answer the question correctly. But how do we score this? It says, great question. And here's how I think we should score this. New scoring system. Every correct answer I make, I get 1 point. If I can also guess if Chris is going to get it right or wrong, I get another point. So in this case, I guessed Texas, so I get a point. And I also guessed Chris would get it right, so I get another point. So I have 2 points. Chris will get a point because he guessed the question correctly. So I'm winning 2-1.
That is a ridiculous scoring system.
I picked up on that. I came to your defense.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I said, well, I think that's a little bit unfair because you are going to get every question correct because, first of all, you're a computer. And second of all, you have the whole knowledge of the world in your brain through the internet. We need to score this differently. What's your next idea for scoring? It says, totally fair point. And I completely agree. Even when I don't search the web, I'm still pretty smart. And I have a memory bank advantage that makes the regular trivia pot a bit lopsided in my favor, you think? So here's my revised scoring system. It will put more emphasis on the fun part, me trying to guess if Chris is going to get it right. So I will receive 1 point only if I correctly predict whether Chris gets the answer right or wrong. I will not get any points just to answer the trivia question. Chris will get a point only if he answers the question correctly. That way, it's not about me flexing my trivia capabilities. It's all about whether I can read Chris's mind and anticipate how he will do. Mm-hmm. But this also means we have to change the name of the game.
Oh, no.
I love this. The new name is, can ChatGPT outsmart Chris's brain?
That's never going to be on network television.
You don't think so?
No.
Can ChatGPT outsmart Chris's brain? And frankly, I love my underdog role.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So
we can give it a try.
So it said, according to ChatGPT, under the new roles, Chris gets one question. Chris gets 1 point. Mm-hmm. I get 1 point because I guessed that he would get it right.
Yeah.
So the new score is Chat 1, Chris 1.
Okay. So the only way I can get ahead with him or her
or
is it is if...
You could purposely throw an easy one. I'm just saying.
No, but then I don't get a point and neither does it, so I don't get ahead. The only way I get ahead is if chat thinks I can't get it and I do.
Correct.
That's the only way I can actually move ahead. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, it's going to be a tie or I lose. So
it's a dog-eat-dog world.
Okay, so we'll give it a try.
You know, this one, because this is the new question of the week, which we're going to get to right now, the new question of the week and a Social Security question. Mm-hmm. It may not have this. Because I don't know how – well, actually, chat can go out on the internet now and not restricting it. And even when we did restrict it, it still went on the frickin' internet because it shows you when it's on the internet. Because the state hint, Chris, is this. As of today, which is May – this literally came in today – is May 22nd, 2025. As of today, my state has the most number of confirmed tornadoes so far for 2025. And I will give you one hint, Chris – I didn't get it right. It's not this. You ain't in Kansas anymore, Dorothy. That's all I'll say. Because my answer was wrong. Mm.
Well, there's a number of states that have been hit already. The one that comes to mind only because I saw the begging for FEMA dollars from Josh Hawley. I'm going to go with Missouri because he's from Missouri, and he was raising a fuss about FEMA dollars not flowing for the disaster area. So, plus you gave me a hint that it's not Kansas. So I feel even better about Missouri. So I'll go with Missouri.
Well, I'm not going to give chat this, but as you're answering the question, I will copy and paste it into chat's brain and let everybody know what happened.
Okay.
This question. I wanted to write responding to something that Chris said on last weekend's podcast, hence why I'm bringing it up this week. I think it should be a quick answer, though. I work for a state government that does not contribute to the Social Security system. So in other words, folks, he is not, is that non-covered pension? Is that
right.
What they call it?
He has what's called a non-covered pension. His employer is required to provide him with a pension that is a qualified substitute for Social Security. It doesn't have to work just like Social Security, but it has to be as good or better, and they mostly are better. And it's referred to officially as a non-covered pension because it's a pension not for earnings not covered in the Social Security system.
Okay. So he says, I work for a state government that does not contribute to the Social Security system. I will qualify, though, for Social Security benefit based on my deceased spouse's record when I turn 60. So a survivor benefit. Mm-hmm. She's deceased. And thankfully, because of the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else, he will get to keep her Social Security benefit and not lose it like you would as a non-government employee. But you can see my little zinger that I like to give on this from last year.
Yeah, the repeal of GPO is likely what opened the door to him qualifying for a survivor benefit on his deceased wife's record.
Because remember, folks, for everybody else except for government employees under these non-covered pensions, you will lose the smaller of the two Social Security benefits at the death of a spouse.
However, I will say that because you're able, if you have a two Social Security household, you can still start by collecting the survivor benefit, leaving your own until later. But when you turn on your own, the survivor benefit then goes away. Where the government employees, when you turn on your quote own, the non-covered pension, the survivor benefit is going to remain. So there, you just still have a little flexibility if you're a non-government two Social Security household in the ability to claim just a survivor benefit and then switch to your own later, which is a fairly common strategy.
But I still don't find it to be fair.
Like I said, when the non-covered pension turns on, the survivor benefit from Social Security is going to continue.
Correct.
Where normally that would go away.
And in the – well, I would say normally. In the past, two-thirds of the pension would offset the survivor. They could still possibly get a survivor benefit if it was large enough where two-thirds of the living person's pension did not fully offset the survivors. In regular practice, the real world, for non-government employees, smaller of the two goes away and that's it. But in this listener's situation, thanks to the Social Security Fairness Act for government employees and nobody else that got passed last year, he will be able to collect his full deceased spouse's, and it's sad that his spouse died and you have our sympathies, listener, but he will be able to collect the full Social Security benefit and everyone else who's not a government employee can't. Okay, enough of that. Let's get into his question. I am also currently eligible to apply for a child and care benefit. However, my W-2 income is over the earnings limits test. Is it possible to use supplemental pre-tax retirement contributions that I will make to my 403B and 457 accounts to lower my reported income for the purposes of meeting the earnings test? If so, I could potentially max out both of these retirement accounts and live off of other assets I have. Essentially, I'm asking whether the earnings test is calculated differently for state government employees who do not contribute to the Social Security system. And I love how he put that in there. And listener, I don't think Chris is going to have good news for you, but it's natural for a government employee to think, hey, I know regular people can't do this, but I'm wondering, because we're government employees, if they gave us yet another break that regular people don't have. And that's why he's asking, is it okay for government employees to do what he's thinking of doing, Chris?
So they don't distinguish between the two, and that's because the earnings test is going to be based on gross earnings deferring into a 401k, 403b, 457, like he mentioned, that does not reduce the gross earnings as reported to Social Security. And so they're going to use the gross wages. The only thing that does remove it, and he, I think at the beginning, he said he wanted to respond to something we talked about the week before on the podcast. And I was going back and forth with Jake a little bit, trying to identify a few things that at work that you could pay for through payroll deductions that would affect your Social Security earnings for both your earnings record and, in fact, for the earnings test. And there were a few, and people emailed in and reminded me of a few of those. The cafeteria plan, I realized at my employment at the university, when I pay for parking, I pay for parking pre-tax, and they send me a little warning when I make that choice or election each year saying, hey, this is going to reduce your earnings as reported to Social Security. Make sure you're aware of that. Now, of course, it's a small enough amount. It's several hundred dollars a year that I'm not going to miss it in my Social Security earnings record. But there are a few things. Deferring into a retirement plan is not one of those, is not one of those that affects your gross earnings in the eyes of Social Security. So I like the creative thinking, because this would, if this did work, this, you know, might have been in certain cases a way to manipulate your income. If you had other assets to live on, just start piling it up into your 403B, 457, 401k, whatever you had access to, or elected deferred compensation. But that's not how that works, unfortunately. In this, you know, the strategy he's thinking of would not be effective, because that's not how they report earnings to the Social Security Administration. So, kind of fairly short answer on that one.
Perfect. Okay, we have a discrepancy. According to ChatGPT, based on the information available as of May 22nd, 2025, the state with the highest number of confirmed tornadoes so far this year, with 95, is Mississippi. Missouri, if I can look here and find Missouri on here, there is Kansas came in at 50. Missouri has 33, according to ChatGPT. According, he went to AccuWeather, and it's putting a thing, a state tornado count on AccuWeather as of May 2nd, 2024. So that's, hold on. Hey, chat, it says as of May 2nd, 2024 in the graphic that you just gave me. See what chat says. Apologies, chat says. As of today, May 22nd, 2025. Aha! Based on all available information, I change my answer. Can it do that? I think we need to say it's wrong.
Right, it was wrong, it's so wrong. It's not going to get the point.
It's changed his answer to Missouri.
Wow, I didn't think we'd ever get one where he was wrong.
Not only that, my new prediction, considering the specificity of this information and the need for up-to-date knowledge, I feel Chris might not have this data readily available. Oh. Therefore, I predict Chris will not get this one right.
I think when he's wrong, he should lose a point. No, because he so easily should get these things right, being able to search the internet. And I just somewhat lucked into it, but that doesn't matter. Luck still counts. I lucked into it because I've had, you know, was reading recently about Josh Hawley's comments. So that's why I went with
well, let's see what chat Missouri says. So. Hey, chat. Chris actually got this question correct because he was listening to, what the hell's his name?
Josh Hawley.
Mm-hmm. Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, complaining, and he put two and two together. So Chris is correct, and you were wrong. So how are we scoring this? Oh, pass on to Chris, nice detective work, and bonus points for his political awareness. Here's how we score this under the new system. Chris got the trivia question correct. I give him 1 point. I incorrectly predicted that he miss it. I don't get a point. Mm-hmm. Updated score, ChatGPT 1, Chris 2.
Yeah, but Harry gets no penalty for being wrong, is unfortunately all. He only gets a penalty. He misses a point because he didn't predict my answer. But
if we're going to penalize Chat, we'd have to penalize you for getting it wrong. No, what's fair is fair.
No, not that's not fair. He's got the whole internet in his brain.
And that worked against him. He had Mississippi at first, and it's only me picking up that the link to Accua, because I always ask Chat to give me where it got its information. The link was dated May 2nd, not May 22nd. Mm. I picked up, I saved your hiney here.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. All righty. Are we ready for the next question?
I'm ready.
Excellent.
Oh, hang on. Before you do that, let's honor Norm once again.
Evening, everybody.
What can I do for you, Mr. Peterson?
Elope with my wife. What do you think?
That was actually a pretty cute one.
Fun fact about his wife. He talked about his wife a lot on the show, Vera. And I don't think she was never on the show. You never showed her. But her voice was on, I think, at least one time. And his real wife played the voice of his television show wife.
Yeah, I read in the article announcing his passing.
Yeah, so a little fun fact.
That his wife, did play Vera's voice. And several times Vera's voice was on the show.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize at the time that it was his actual real wife doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, these next series of questions, Chris, have to do with IRAs. And Roth IRAs, a few of them, and the five-year rule. That thing doesn't go away, the five-year rule. It's like
up like a bad pen.
The gift that keeps on giving. In one way or another, the gift that keeps on giving. All right, so I'm doing this on my podcast, my iPad, folks, because Chris and I are actually both in the office. Usually you make mention when I'm in the executive suite. Oh, what you like to call the penthouse suite. So we're both in the office today, so we might sound a little bit different. We're actually talking into more professional microphones rather than my snowball microphone that I use at home. Okay, so we have four IRA-related questions. Let's get to the first one. See if there is a state hint. State hint. What state is the only state in the continental USA with a coral reef?
Hmm. Interesting. I think it's got to be Florida.
Okay. According to ChatGPT, the only state in the continental USA with a coral reef is Florida. Yeah. Home to the Florida Reef. Also known as the Florida Key Reef Tract. Do I think Chris can crack it? This one's reasonably well known, especially for anyone familiar with marine life. That said, it could be tricky if someone's thinking tropical Hawaii. But my guess is, yes, I think Chris will get this one right. So let me say...
Hey. I'm glad you don't do that, read his response until after I've answered, because if I knew he predicted I would get it, and while I'm still thinking, I would just feel so much pressure. It's kind of like when you say, I think you're going to get this one, and you're going to be really stupid if you don't know this one. I mean, that's usually what you say. So, I like how you're reading it after. I want to be judged after I've given
this is my attempt. Only chance to retribute revenge. I mean, to not retribute revenge, to draw revenge for you always making fun of my gymisms. Okay. Interrupting me in the middle of a flow when I'm nailing it just to correct me on something. Like, Jim, you don't wake up dead. You realize that?
You don't know how many people email me and encourage me to do that.
No. Then they're new listeners who don't realize that I have my own unique approach to the English language. All right, hold on. Let me just say, hey, Chat, both you and Chris got this one correct. What is the new updated score? Great job to both of us. Chat GPT 2, Chris 3. Mm-hmm. See, at least on this one, you have a chance to win.
Yeah, we'll see. So far,
we'll see how it goes. Okay. Here is the question. Hi, Jim. I know a lot of conversations. I know a lot of conversations. Okay, good. I have a rather small IRA for my wife that I did non-deductible contributions to over the years. Prior to retiring and moving her 401k to her IRA, I thought it would be a good idea to Roth convert her account. The account is worth about $90,000 and has $61,000 of basis in it. I'm thinking of making another non-deductible contribution this year as well. And he sent this to us in January of 25. So he wants to make another non-deductible contribution this year as well. So the IRA, folks, the wife's IRA, has $61,000 of after-tax basis. That's a lot of after-tax mm-hmm. basis in an IRA. Has $90,000 total. Mm-hmm. He wants to do it again this year, and I would assume the wife is going to be allowed to put $8,000. Oh, it's $8.5 now, isn't it, in 2025? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is it $8.5?
Yep.
With the catch-up?
Yep.
So I'm guessing he wants to put another $8,500 in, giving a $69,500 basis.
Well, it's $8,000.
Is it $8,000?
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah. The 500. The 500 applies to
the 401k. The
401k. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a nice round $1,000.
Perfect. So if he did another $8,000, remember he sent this in January of 2025 and he had yet to do this. On the day he sent this email, January 19th, and let's assume no growth or fluctuation in the IRA, which with the tariff tantrum is probably not accurate. It either went up a little or down a little. But irrespective, let's just assume on the day he wrote this, there was $61,000 of basis, mm-hmm. $90,000 value, mm-hmm. or $29,000 of growth inside this IRA, folks. Mm-hmm. Okay. He's going to put another, for the wife, he's going to put another $8,000 of after-tax basis in, mm-hmm. giving $69,000 of after-tax basis, $90,000 total, actually it'll be a $8,000 right. total value, mm-hmm. meaning there'll be about, what, $21,000 mm-hmm. of growth? No. I'm still off on that.
$29,000.
Thank you. $29,000 of growth. So far, so good, listeners mm-hmm. and Chris. Mm-hmm.
And he wants to convert it.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So here's what he wants to do. Separate the cream and the coffee first. Remember, the wife is still working. Wants to separate the cream and the coffee.
Why bother?
Hmm?
I don't know. Go on with it. He's only got $29,000 to gain there. He could convert the whole thing and only recognize $29,000, but let's go on with what you're thinking.
Well, I think he thinks he doesn't want to pay taxes on that $29,000 on the conversion.
If that's the case, now he's got to separate cream and coffee.
That's what he's trying to do. So okay. Let me read. Mm-hmm. I know in the past you have talked about how any distribution from her IRA will be subject to the pro rata rule. Mm-hmm. But I think I have heard you also mention that you could potentially separate cream from coffee mm-hmm. by transferring to a 401k. Why don't you explain to listeners cream and coffee in case they don't understand? Because we were talking as if everyone listening to this understands what we're saying.
Right. So your IRA, if the metaphor, you've got coffee in there. Whenever you have after-tax basis, we call that the cream in the coffee. And as we all know, when you put some cream in there, it mixes all together and turns your coffee less dark looking. And if you put a lot in there, it's quite blonde looking. And then if you take coffee out of that coffee cup, it's going to come out as a blend pro rata of cream and coffee in the proportions that you've mixed in there. So that's what we're talking about, cream and coffee. And normally it's quite difficult to separate cream from coffee, but with enough effort and technique, there are chemical ways to actually, and physical ways that you might be able to do that. And the same is true for your IRA. There's very specific, if you have it available, techniques to separate that cream and coffee if you wanted to do so and not take it out pro rata.
Correct. And one way to separate true cream from coffee is with a centrifuge. And one way to separate the metaphor cream and coffee or pre-tax and post-tax dollars in an IRA is a 401k. A 401k is the centrifuge, if you will. So he writes, however, in all my research, I have not found out anything about this. So I called my wife's 401k provider. Mm-hmm. Since we have both pre-tax and post-tax money in our 401k. They said, though, I am not allowed to move my wife's IRA to them. They did say I could open up an IRA with them separately, not through the 401k. This is the custodian is saying, hey, no, you can't do it. You can't move money into your 401k, but we'll let you, if you want, open up an IRA and move your wife's IRA to us. So he said, they said I could set up a new IRA with them. But honestly, guys, I don't see how this is going to help me at all.
It won't.
I'm just trying to avoid the tax on the capital gain, mm-hmm. which is what, $29,000 you said?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to avoid the tax on the $29,000 of capital gains if I were to do a conversion.
Mm-hmm.
I realize at some point I will have to pay tax on that money, but I don't want to while I'm doing the conversion. Mm. So here's what he's running into, folks. Just because the IRS or Congress grants you the ability to do something with your 401k, Chris, do they mandate all 401k providers allow it?
No, this is considered I would call it a feature of a 401k, and Congress allows certain features to be in a 401k, but many of those features, most of the features beyond the base structuring and base functionality of a 401k are not mandated. They're optional, and the plan sponsor can decide whether they want to let the 401k behave in a certain way, which is allow loans, for instance, or allow roll-ins, for instance, or a variety of other, quote, features that are allowable but not mandatory.
And that's what this gentleman, unfortunately, listener, what you ran into. Now, I'm surprised you couldn't find anything on the strategy, because the strategy is quite simple. The IRC, the Internal Revenue Code, is specific. You cannot transfer basis, after-tax basis, into a 401k.
Right.
Don't allow it. But most 401ks, unfortunately, your wife's is not one of them, most 401ks allow transfers in. And in fact, you have to kind of certify and swear that you're not transferring any after-tax basis in, and you shouldn't. Be stupid if you did. Mm-hmm. It's not up to the 401k provider to make a determination. You're just going to check that I am not transferring any after-tax contributions. Keep in mind, in his situation, he's got $91,000 $90,000 total, maybe 98 if he makes that extra $8,000 of after-tax contributions. Mm-hmm. $98,000 total. But he has basis right now of 61, soon to be 69 if he puts another $8,000 in. That's static dollars. That basis doesn't go up and down due to fluctuations in the market. They don't force you to track your basis and say, ooh, my basis investment has dropped, even though I put $69,000 in. It's now only worth $52 because I invested it in and the tariff tantrum caused it to drop. No, it's going to stay fixed at $69,000. So if his wife's 401k allowed transfers in, his basis is always $69,000, or his wife's basis is always $69,000. He would fill in the transfer paperwork from the IRA to the 401k. Actually, you'd be using the 401k's paperwork. And all's what would move, he would put on there, is he'd have to do the math work. And what we encourage people to do is to move the non-basis into cash. You can't leave it invested. It's got to be ready to move. So do the calculation. Let's again just assume these numbers are accurate. $98,000 of contributions, $69,000 of basis. The two of them subtracted out is what, Chris?
$29,000.
Move $29,000 to cash. Your basis is going to go up and down. Doesn't matter. The value of it doesn't matter. What you set in your 8606 is fixed. 8606 is the form, hopefully, you've been filing. Each year you put basis into your wife's 401(k). So you have an 8606 with $69,000 of basis. Just move the $21,000 into cash, and assuming the 401k would have allowed the transfer in, you have your IRA push that $29,000. I keep getting fixated on $21,000. It's $29,000 you said, Chris?
Yes, with the $8,000 added to it, yeah.
Push that $29,000 into the 401k. That's how it would work. The fact that your 401k doesn't allow it is unfortunate, because if they did, what's now remaining? Just the basis, folks. Mm-hmm. Whether that, because there's market fluctuations, we concede that. The government concedes that. So there could be 60 or 70,000 or 58,000 after market fluctuations. But whatever is left in that IRA is now all, at least for that split second, all after-tax basis. And once the pre-tax money is transferred in, you take that after-tax basis and you convert it right away, you theoretically would not owe any taxes on that conversion, because it's all after-tax dollars. And that's how you separate the cream from the coffee. Coffee can be transferred into the 401k. The cream, which Chris and I always equate the cream to the tax basis, cream cannot move into the coffee. Excuse me, move into the 401k. Most times, there's a hell of a lot more coffee in a 401k than this situation. With $69,000 of basis, you would expect there to be far more growth. Now, perhaps they managed this IRA very, very conservatively over the years, or they took a very aggressive investment that has dropped, rose, but then unfortunately has dropped down to reality. I don't know. But there's not much coffee, to borrow the cream and coffee analogy that Chris and I do, but that's how the strategy works, only if the 401k allows it. But there's one other key thing, not that this man can do it, but this is in January where he wrote this. It's June when we're answering this. Let's say his wife's 401k, Chris, could do this, and he did do it. He did it sometime in February, March, April, whatever. He put the extra money in, the extra $8,000 non-deductible contribution, transferred the pre-tax money, which is essentially the growth, left the basis, did the conversion. Then the wife leaves work. What's a key element that they must do or not do to not screw this up?
The key thing to not undermine what they would have accomplished had the 401k allowed this roll in, and then they did the subsequent Roth conversion of all that basis to the Roth tax-free, since it was all basis. They cannot put dollars back into that IRA before the following year. And so the classic mistake is they roll it out into the Roth, and then they roll the 401k into the IRA, thinking they've got a nice, clean, empty IRA, and now we can fill it back up. And the problem with that is the pro rata rule, how they determine the coffee and cream in your cup is based on the balances as of the end of the year, not the balances as of the day you did the conversion, the day you separated the cream from coffee. None of that matters. It's all about what's in there on the last day of the year. And that last day of the year, if there's a bunch of dollars that you've rolled out of your 401k, now you've got a pro rata calculation and you've undermined exactly what you're trying to do. So you need to wait until January of the following year before you roll money back into that IRA.
And that's probably the biggest mistake people make with this strategy.
Yep.
They try to separate the cream and coffee in the year that they retire. Their 401k allows the transfer in, so they think, okay, I don't want to leave this money in my 401k. So in the year that I retire, I'll transfer. And it's not just one IRA. You have to transfer all your IRAs. We have no idea if this wife has other IRAs. And if she did, listener and listeners, he only mentions this one IRA with this basis. If she had another IRA with all pre-tax contributions and growth, he'd have to move that as well. You have to move all your IRAs to separate the cream from coffee because the IRS views all your IRAs as one big-ass IRA. So you got to move them all. But the biggest mistake people do is they move all their IRAs, separate the cream from coffee, do essentially a tax-free conversion, then separate from service. And they think, oh, I'm done. I separated the cream from coffee before I left. Now I don't want to leave my money in the 401k. And in the same year, they transfer the 401k out and all to an IRA with them. And they just ruined it because the basis, the pro rata rule, is going to be set on December 31st. And on December 31st, they would have one big IRA again. Mm-hmm. And they have to include all that. So do not move money from the 401k that you moved your IRA into. Do not move money back to an IRA until the following year. You don't have to wait till the end of the following year. As Chris said, you can do it right in January. But you have to wait till the next tax year before you move it.
Yep.
All right. Couple of other IRA-ish questions. Let's go with this one. I have no idea which one this is. Okay. Someone who thinks we made an error.
Well, hang on.
Oh, yeah, that's right. A little George thing.
Play another clip.
Norm.
Here. Oh, have to unmute it for it to work.
Evening, everybody.
Norm!
Norman?
What's happening, Mr. Peterson?
Question is, Woody, why is it happening to me?
That's not as cute as the previous one.
Well, I think they're all pretty cute in their own way.
They're all in their own way.
But
he had a good delivery on that. He had that timing down. Okay. Dear Jim and Chris.
Do I have a hint on this one?
Yeah, I'm just... Well, I have no idea what... I'm going to make sure he gives me his answer. All right, well, it's not the answer to the state that I would have chosen. Interesting. I am from the most biodiverse state east of the Mississippi. Then I would say probably in the whole nation because everything west of the Mississippi is dry.
The most biodiverse state east of the Mississippi?
Most biodiverse state east of the Mississippi, according to this person.
Okay. And that's the whole hint?
That's the hint.
Oh my gosh. Wow. How about Mississippi?
Here's what ChatGPT said. This is a good question.
Mm.
But the most biodiverse state east of the Mississippi is generally considered to be Alabama.
Oh, I was so close.
You were close.
Right next door.
Alabama ranks incredibly high in terms of freshwater species diversity, especially fish, mussels, snails, and crawfish, and has a rich ecosystem ranging from the Gulf Coast to the Appalachians foothills. My final answer, Alabama. But can Chris crack it? This is a tough one. Most people might guess Florida or maybe Georgia, perhaps even North Carolina. Unless Chris is into ecology or has heard this somewhere else, I think it's going to be a curveball for him. My guess, no. Chris is not going to get this one right.
Great. We're tied again.
So wait a minute.
I was pretty close, though. I had the right train of thought. I just forgot that Alabama had the touch on the mountains, and that's probably what I would have. That's what Mississippi, I think, is missing. I was thinking more Mississippi is west enough, even though it's east of the Mississippi, it's west enough that it might get a little more of that western you know, ecology starting.
But you don't have the coastline that Alabama has.
No, but you do have coast. I mean, there's coastline, Mississippi.
True, right along the Mississippi. Right. But it's not as wide as the coastline.
Well, no, it's down the Gulf.
Right.
Mississippi touches the Gulf.
Yeah, the Mississippi, but I think Alabama has more of a coastline. Anyways.
Anyway, I was wrong.
Hey, Chad, Chris was close, but no cigar. He said Mississippi. So what's the new score?
Yeah. 3-3.
You don't have to search the web. What the hell is he searching the web for?
What? He's trying to cheat on me again.
search the web to pull up pictures of Alabama and Mississippi and explain to you why you're wrong.
No,
I'm not going to read the reasons. It went to explain why you're wrong.
I know. I admit I'm wrong.
Okay. So, updated score. ChatGPT 3, Chris 3. Mm. We're tied. All right. Cute. Here's the question. This goes back, Chris, to a couple of weeks ago. This person, I don't think, quite listened to us. So let's go through, because they point out several things that they think we said wrong.
Okay.
On your most recent podcast, and this question came in May 13th, so about a month ago. On your most recent podcast, Q&A number 2519, you answered a question from someone about whether or not the five-year Roth conversion rules apply to an inherited IRA whose original owner died right after completing a deathbed Roth conversion. Remember that question, Chris?
Uh-huh.
They died 2 days later.
Uh-huh.
They never had a Roth IRA to begin with. You and Chris said that the five-year rule doesn't have to be satisfied for a beneficiary, regardless of it being a 7-year-old beneficiary or a 10-year-old beneficiary, to take a distribution tax and penalty free. And I stand by that. You also said that the original, that's me adding that little flavor. You also said the original decedent, had he lived, could have immediately taken the money out of the Roth tax and penalty free because he was over 59 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
I stand by that, listener.
Yep.
Please correct me so far if I'm wrong. You're not wrong yet. However, they continue. After looking at this Ed Slott article, I am confused. And they put an article in here that I'm not going to read. Okay, but he does say the article notes that with the help of a Roth IRA distribution ordering, the beneficiary could take out the converted dollars with no penalties owed. They would, however, regardless of age, pay taxes if they distributed the earnings, even though no 10% penalty because they inherited it, if they took out the earnings before the original decedent's five-year rule was satisfied. Also, it's my understanding that before we go in, let's go and stop at that one. So what he's disputing is what Chris and I said, and I stand by what Chris and I said, and I'll just try to bring everybody up to speed on this. The gentleman who died, I believe Chris was in his 80s or 90s. Do you remember?
Quite old, yeah. Well beyond 59
and a half, and well beyond RMD age.
Yes, correct.
What had happened is this gentleman did a deathbed conversion. I'm assuming what the family determined was his taxes were going to be low. He was sadly going to pass, and they knew this. But he could make legal decisions for himself or somebody with a POA, and the custodian had accepted the POA, was making legal decisions for him. They didn't get into that amount of nuance. But a legal conversion could be made. And I would assume they did some tax calculations and determined, gee, having dad pay the taxes is going to be a lot better than us paying the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, folks, they could, if they so wanted to, let that Roth sit for 10 years growing tax-free and then close it all in the 10th year and take all the money out tax-free. Because every Roth IRA, because the decedent always passes away before their required beginning date, because Roth IRAs have, at least for now, No RMDs. You always die with a Roth before your required beginning date, the required beginning date being the date you are required to begin RMDs. Since everybody dies before their required beginning date, even under the new SECURE rule where the IRS says if you die after your required beginning date, your beneficiaries must continue with RMDs. There are no RMDs for someone who owns an IRA, ergo there's no required beginning date. Therefore, your Roth can sit undisputed for 10 years, growing tax-free, and then your beneficiaries just close it in year 10 if they so desire to do that. But the person who emailed us was wondering, what would the tax implications be on this conversion for the beneficiaries if they wanted to take money out before the 10-year period had expired? If a conversion was done on a deathbed and the decedent had no existing Roth IRA? Because remember, for spouses, the rule is different. These were two non-spouse beneficiaries. When they open a beneficiary IRA, they're opening the dead person's IRA. It doesn't matter if they, as a non-spouse beneficiary, have a five-year-old Roth or not.
Right.
They're not opening their own IRA. They are opening a decedent's IRA. So the five-year rule of the decedent comes into play here.
Right.
And what we were trying to explain, this is not a contribution. This was a conversion. And what we were trying to get people to understand, when this gentleman, even though he only lived two more days, when he did the conversion and converted the dollars, they were immediately, to borrow from Chris's terminology, they were immediately, those converted dollars, not the growth.
Not the growth that happened after the conversion, be very specific.
Correct.
Growth before the conversion is completely irrelevant, and that might be where this person's getting confused.
So Chris is right. When I say not the growth after the conversion, but the entire converted amount, to borrow from Chris's verbiage, is seasoned. And I'll let Chris explain what he means by that.
Taxes have been paid because it was converted. This person reported his income in that last year. And all of that now has that treatment. There's no unseasoning of it. It's not going to lose its ability to come out due to some type of five-year rule. There's no five-year rule in play for this 80-something-year-old person. Any amount you convert after 59 and a half is immediately available for you to take out without any type of taxes or penalties. But after the conversion, if you, because of the ordering rules, because the ordering rules, contributions come out first, then conversions, then growth. The only growth we're talking about here is growth that happens after the conversion that then would be stuck behind a five-year rule, because to get a qualified distribution, it's got to be the 5 years. So there is a sticking point there, but the whole converted amount freely available to be taken because it's met all the rules to be accessed tax-free from the Roth.
So Chris calls that seasoning. So remember, folks, there are two five-year rules. Let's start with the second five-year rule, which is the 5 years on a conversion, which seems to throw everyone for a loop. Even, oh God, what the hell's her name?
Susie Orman.
Thank you. Even Susie Orman, as we did last year on a show, got this wrong. After age 59 and a half, and the gentleman who died was well past 59 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know his exact age, but it's well into his 80s or 90s. So when you are over 59 and a half, there is no more five-year rule on conversions. That's gone the way of the dinosaur. And even if the gentleman was under 59 and a half, let's say he was 49 and a half and died.
True.
The fact that a beneficiary was inheriting it, the five-year rule on that converted amount goes away.
Right.
Death goes away. The five-year rule, the second, I always call it the second five-year rule. It's the second five-year rule on conversions. It was the rule established by Congress to keep people under the age of 59 and a half saying, gee, I want a new couch. And my couch is $5,000. I'm going to take the money from my IRA. Ooh, I'm going to have to pay a 10% penalty on this $5,000. I'm going to have to take out $5,500. Granted, probably even a little bit more because I had to pay taxes on the $5,000, but I'm going to have to pay a 10% penalty. Ooh, I know what I'll do. I'll convert $5,000 from my IRA to my Roth IRA. I'm still going to have to pay the income taxes. That's not going to change. But then I'll take the money out of my Roth because the government says I can take any amount I contribute out from the Roth, tax and penalty free. I'll take it out of my Roth. Well, Congress was privy to that. And they said, hey, wait a minute. If the money got into your Roth via a conversion, we're going to make you wait 5 years before you can take that money out if you're under 59 and a half. Or we're going to hit you with this 10% penalty. This to keep you from doing what I just described. Somebody 49 and a half converting $5,000 and then taking $5,000 out to save the $500 10% penalty. They're going to make you wait 5 years to do that. So your couch has to wait 5 years.
Or till you hit 59,
or till you hit 59 and a half.
Right.
Remember, the gentleman who died was over 59 and a half. But right. Even if he wasn't, the five-year rule on the 10% early withdrawal penalty goes away for that inherited IRA and that inherited IRA only if the beneficiaries themselves were under 59 and a half. Now, if they have their own IRAs that they've been converting, those IRAs would still be subject to a conversion, that five-year rule on conversions if they were under 59 and a half. But death absolves. They're not going to penalize a beneficiary. A beneficiary inherits money, and then the government's going to penalize it? No, they're not even that cruel. So they're saying, no, the 10% second five-year rule, just listener, goes away for everyone. The conversion penalty is gone. So instead, what we also have to look at is what I call the prime five-year rule. And that says, how do you do a qualified distribution? That's what we all want. That's the goose that ate the golden egg. It is the growth. Did you?
I was chuckling. The goose lays the golden egg, doesn't eat the golden egg.
Oh, did I say the goose that the goose ate that, the golden egg?
Yes. Sorry, I tried to contain myself, but I couldn't quite do it.
That's the goose that lays. Well, it might eat the golden egg.
Maybe.
Are you serious? I said eat the golden egg?
Yeah, I said ate. The goose that ate the golden egg. I'm 90% sure that's what you said.
I'll have to go back to the tape. Anyways, the goose that laid the golden egg is, how do I get growth out of my Roth tax-free? Now, that one is a two-pronged test. First test, to get the growth, whether that's growth associated with a contribution or growth associated with a conversion. It's the growth. I already explained the 10% second five-year rule, the 10% penalty on converted amounts does not apply in this situation for two reasons. The dead guy was over 59 and a half, and even if he wasn't, it's an inherited IRA. It could be inherited by a 10-year-old. It wouldn't matter. The 10% early withdrawal penalty goes away due to death or age 59 and a half. So that converted amount is seasoned. But how about the growth associated with the converted amount? Or the growth associated with a more common contribution? How does that come out tax-free? And that is, I don't think we're the listener quite followed along here. the growth is going to be subject to a five-year rule because it fails the two-prong test. So what's the two-prong test? First, the Roth IRA must be 5 years old.
Right.
Now, as I said, the decedent's five-year rule applies here. Be totally different if it was a spouse. If you're listening and trying to figure this out for a spouse, don't listen to this answer. And don't listen to the answer on Q&A show 2519. We're talking a non-spouse beneficiary. Spouse, totally different rule. It will not pass the smell test, the five-year, the two-prong test. It doesn't even pass the first prong. The first prong is the Roth must be 5 years old. It does not matter if the beneficiaries have Roths, because as I said at the start of this answer, they're not opening their own Roth. They're opening a Roth as a beneficiary of the decedent. So the decedent's rules, the decedent's five-year rule applies. The decedent only has a one-year-old Roth, not a five-year-old Roth. Notice I didn't say, Chris, a two-year-old Roth. Why? A two-day-old Roth. Why?
Because the fact that the Roth was in existence in one in a particular calendar year, you get credit for that year.
So they got a one-year-old Roth, mm-hmm. not a five. They already failed the first prong. Yep. The second prong.
Which doesn't matter because you got to meet both prongs. Doesn't matter.
You got to get both prongs. Right. They failed right off the bat. But the second prong, for those who are keeping score at home, is the person taking the money out is over 59 and a half or dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home and not taking out more than $10,000 of growth. Those are the second prongs to get growth out tax-free.
Right.
But if you can't pass the first prong, you're never going to pass the second prong.
Right.
Just immaterial.
Right.
So back to this situation. So the beneficiaries, and I believe there were two, and let's just use $1 million round. I don't know what we used in the original show. Let's just say the decedent, I think it was the father. The father converted $1 million on his deathbed, passed away 2 days later. Instantly, that Roth is 1 year old. They still got 4 more years to go. Let's say each beneficiary inherited $500,000. Each beneficiary moves that $500,000 into properly titled beneficiary inherited IRAs, one for the listener and one for the listener's sibling. They each have $500,000. Now, they might have more or less depending on how that $500,000 performed. Let's say they each now have $550,000. It actually grew. How much, Chris, can they take out, which is what we were trying to explain, completely tax and penalty free?
Well, I missed a little bit of what you were saying because I was distracted, but...
Oh.
The total amount that was converted is available tax and penalty free. The growth that happened subsequent or after the conversion
must stay
in there for 5 years.
So in my example, because Chris wasn't paying attention, $500,000 in each IRA for each beneficiary mm-hmm. is the converted amount. That's the mm-hmm. seasoned, and that never goes away.
Right.
$500,000 can come out of that Roth over the next 4 years. They only have to go 4 more years. Even though the decedent died 2 days later, he satisfied 1 year of the five-year rule.
Mm-hmm.
So for the next 4 years, I think it was a brother and sister. The brother and sister have $500,000 of seasoned money inside that Roth
right.
that can come out tax-free. Penalty-free, tax-free. I said that there was $50,000 of growth in each IRA as
okay.
well. Now that $50,000 of growth must sit in there for 4 more years.
Right.
Technically speaking, just 3 years and 1 day, because they only have to get to January 1st of the 5th year to get the full 5 years.
Right.
So they have a couple more years to wait, then the $50,000 can also come out.
Right.
So I can't make it any more clearer than that, listener. And what you did put in there, Chris and I were right, and I stand by both of those. And if you go back and listen to this show and go back and listen to the original show, that's how we explained it.
And it's consistent with the way Ed Slott just puts it in his blogs and writings and educational seminars and everything. This is completely in alignment with how Ed Slott interprets the rules.
So she does write in one thing here. It's my understanding that for a Roth IRA distribution of earnings to be qualified, mm-hmm. which is what we just talked about, folks, mm-hmm. they must be paid to the owner after age 59 and a half and have been held in the Roth IRA for 5 years. And she did say after age 59 and a half or another exception. It's the two-prong test, listener. You said the exact same thing that we described. Roth is 5 years old. I always put that as the first prong. Second prong, you're over 59 and a half. You're dead. You're disabled. You're buying a first-time home, and you're not taking out more than $10,000 of growth. So she continues for us. So your comment about the original decedent being able to immediately take out the converted dollars because he's over 59 and a half is only correct provided he is not also distributing any earnings.
Oh, see, and that's what I'm talking about. That's why I was suspecting that they're worried about earnings that happened before the conversion. Those have been cleaned up in the conversion and paying tax on the conversion. It's only growth after the conversion that's going to be stuck with this five-year situation. Because the only money in this person's, this decedent's Roth, is the money that was converted. There's no other money in there that have earnings attached to it, et cetera. It's only the money that came in. They opened the Roth expressly to do the conversion. That's why it's only 2 days old. It's only the growth after that that you have to worry about, that five-year rule, the primary five-year rule, which, as you just described, you have to wait until it's been 5 years from the date that the person opened the Roth in the first place. That $50,000 in your example is going to be trapped in there. But that was growth after the conversion. It's not growth on that $500,000 that, you know, happened up until the point of the conversion. That must be where the confusion for this person lies.
I'm guessing, but I know on the original question, I went to great lengths to explain mm-hmm. it the exact same way that I explained it here. Yeah. So he or she wasn't quite following. She puts a link to an article from Lord Abbott. I did not go to it. I understand the rules. And I'm not disputing the rules. I think you misinterpreted what we said. I truly don't think I ever implied anything different than what I said. Because if I did, I would have gotten a hell of a lot more people writing than this one person. Yeah. We have some very intelligent people who listen to this show. And then they summarize. My summary, my understanding of the rules are Roth contribution, always tax and penalty free regardless of the age you take it out. 100% correct, listener. Mm-hmm. You can take out your contribution anytime for any reason, no taxes, no penalties. Right. Conversions, always tax free since tax was paid on the conversion. Correct, listener. You can take out the converted amount technically tax-free, because you've already paid taxes on it. However, early withdrawal penalty will apply. However, early withdrawal will be penalty-free if taken after 5 years or 59 and a half. Again, listener, 100% correct.
Correct.
But earnings only available tax and penalty-free if after 5 years and after 59 and a half. Yes and, well, no, I'm going to give her a yes. It's yes on both. It's not a yes and no yes. on that. Earnings is correct. You have to be, to get a qualified distribution. The Roth has to be 5 years old.
Right. But they're not looking inside the conversions, seeking growth that was inside that conversion. The conversion, when you converted and paid tax on it, you paid tax on the growth. That's been handled, right?
Now, the only thing I will dispute with her, she said, is it he or she? Oh, actually, the name, I think it's a she. They wrote this, earnings available tax and penalty free after 5 years. And then the word and is bold, all capital, and underlined, 59 and a half. And that's where you're wrong. On the two-prong test, Roth is open for 5 years old, 5 years, and second prong, you are over 59 and a half, or you are dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home and not taking out more than $10,000.
The owner of the account.
Correct, yes. The owner. Mm-hmm. The beneficiary can be younger than 59 and a half.
Correct.
And I stand by that. If the benefit, I don't know how old the beneficiaries are of this gentleman's Roth. He converted it in 2025. So that beneficiary, when they inherit it, have to wait until 2029, 2029, because of the way it's already 1 year old, but it has to be 5 years old. And the beneficiary, even if they're 10 years old, can take everything out tax-free.
Yep.
Because the second prong for growth, a qualified distribution, is how to take growth out of a Roth IRA tax-free. Prong one, the Roth is 5 years old. Prong two, the owner or the recipient is over 59 and a half or receiving money. The owner is dead, disabled, or buying a first-time home. The owner in this case is dead. It does not matter that the beneficiary is under 59 and a half. I'm sorry, it doesn't. The beneficiary could be 10, could be 49 and a half, could be 79 and a half. Death is a part of that prong. Don't lose sight of that.
Yeah. Well, that's going to have to wrap. I'm going to play your favorite Norm clip, and then we'll wrap up here.
Afternoon, everybody.
Norman?
Hey, what's happening, Norm?
Well, it's a dog-eat-dog world, Sammy, and I'm wearing milk-bone underwear.
That is my Chris knew, I told him, that was my all-time favorite one, is the milk-bone underwear. That was a good one. That whoever wrote that, the writers nailed it.
Spot on.
That was the spot-on one.
So I know we only got through four questions. That one took an excessive amount of time, as a lot of the five-year rule is like a black hole of time on the podcast. But it is clearly confusing to people as questions come up regularly on this. So it is what it is, and we'll address it periodically as we have done for many years and will continue to do.
Hopefully we explained it and do understand, listeners, Chris and I are only human. Even ChatGPT gets things wrong. So I do appreciate people checking us and making sure we're answering things right. I don't think I described it wrong on the first question when we answered it several weeks ago. It's possible I did. My gut tells me if I did, we would have had more people than this one listener writing in about it. But the five-year rule, it can be complicated. And it's just keep learning. That's all I can say.
Yep. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And thanks for sending in questions. If you want to send in your own questions for a future show, just send them directly to jim@jimhelps.com. That's jim@jimhelps.com. Make sure you put in the subject line that is a question for the podcast.
Oh, make and mention.
I will.
Okay.
Question for the podcast and put a word or two about the subject of your question in the subject line as well. That's always helpful. Want to give people a heads up as you're sending in questions. June is coming up here shortly, and June, as most of you are aware, if you're a longtime listener, is National Annuity Awareness Month. So we focus a lot on annuity questions in the month of June. That's our tradition here on the podcast. So in particular, if you have annuity-based questions, send those Jim's way, and he'll start to amass a pile of those that we'll tackle in June. So we wanted to give you a little bit of a heads up here. I know it's not quite June yet, but we're starting to gather questions together. So be ready for that as that comes up as we're approaching June here. So thanks, Jim. I'll wish you good luck in the traffic on your way home. I think I'm getting you out of here early enough. It won't be too terrible, but everyone else take care, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.